This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Bell Alexander, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street. Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. There will be a community fair, community panel, and Michelle will read from her book. For more info, go to kboo.fm.
Into a world I plunge, through my headphones, escape into the streetlight. I begin to believe in destiny when my...
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new statistics show a continued racial bias in the city's drug exclusion area policy.
The Obama administration continues its crackdown on medical marijuana patients, exceeding the Bush administration's.
Six activists are arrested in southeast Texas for blockading construction of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 4th, 2013. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Keegan Heron. Governor Kitzhaber administered the oath of office to four elected officials today. Oregon's Secretary of State, Treasurer, and Labor Commissioner were all re-elected last November and sworn in this morning. Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, who won a special election last June, also took the oath of office. All four are Democrats and will serve four-year terms. Last night in Washington, D.C., Vice President Joe Biden swore in 13 new senators. Among them was Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin, the country's first openly gay senator.
New statistics obtained by the Portland Mercury show that Portland's updated drug enforcement area policy continues to show racial bias. The policy excludes those found in possession of illicit substances from ever again setting foot in select areas of this city, such as downtown Portland. The previous system, called drug exclusion zones, was allowed to expire in 2007 due to concerns over racial profiling. The new policy, which took effect in 2011, was thought to be an improvement in that exclusions are now handed out by a judge rather than at a police officer's discretion. However, according to Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, the majority of those cited have one easily identifiable characteristic, the color of their skin. Of the 99 people arrested for violating a stay-away order, 58 were African-American, much higher than the rate of minorities given exclusion orders.
A recent lawsuit filed by the Portland Law Collective against the Portland Police Bureau claims that five officers gained unlawful entry to a Portland couple's home in August of 2011. The lawsuit asks for $70,000 as well as attorney's fees. Police claim a neighbor reported yelling and pounding from the home of Sarah Lynn Hill and Brett Lopez around 11:30. They also maintain that officers were on the back balcony of the apartment for an hour before entering through an unlocked front door, at which point Lopez told them to leave. The suit alleges that Lopez was tasered twice and later arrested for harassment and interfering with a police officer. A jury later acquitted him of those charges. Attorney for the plaintiffs, Ben Hale, said, "The heart of this lawsuit is after police found the couple sleeping in bed, they should have left the home, knowing there is no emergency. Instead, they turned it into confrontation and escalated the violence until they had total control."
The phone company CenturyLink has filed an injunction to stop the enforcement of a new tax on landline phones approved by the Portland City Council in November. CenturyLink filed the lawsuit in Multnomah County Circuit Court, claiming the new tax unfairly discriminates against landlines. The tax does not affect cell phones. Former Mayor Sam Adams promoted the measure as a way to raise millions of dollars to pay for police reforms mandated by the U.S. Justice Department after a 13-month-long investigation of the Portland police. According to the lawsuit, the new tax undermines CenturyLink's ability to compete and violates state and federal law. CenturyLink acquired Qwest in 2011 and is now the second-largest phone service provider in the Portland area.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6, where we'll reflect on the better parts of 2012. Call in with the small things you've thought of doing this year to make our world a happier place. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rainy in the low 40s through the weekend.
It's 5:06, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
And now for some happy talk, by which I mean a non-corporate, little-d democratic, and altogether pleasurable economic development that's spreading across our country. In a word, beer. More specifically, craft breweries are flourishing from Maine to Oregon, with happy hopheads in town after town now able to boast of their own local, unique, zesty, and fun batch of suds. While Anheuser-Busch, now owned by a German conglomerate, and Miller Coors, partially owned by Canadians, still dominate America's beer market, sales of the nondescript national brands have soured in recent years. But innovative small-batch hometown yeast wranglers have tapped a burgeoning market of brewski lovers who are reaching for the real gusto. Since 2004, craft beers have doubled their share of the U.S. market. Some 250 upstart breweries opened last year alone, bringing their total number to nearly 2,000. This has been a true populist economic phenomenon. Consumers and artisans have found each other and spontaneously created an alternative, locally based economy that helps sustain themselves and their community, rather than having their money siphoned out by faraway profit takers. Of course, the big boys are slyly trying to sink their own taps into the craft success of the small guys. Budweiser and Miller, for example, are now marketing pretend craft beers, having bought such once local brands as Chicago's Goose Island and Wisconsin's Leinenkugel. Unabashed by this consumer deception, however, a Miller spokesman sniffed, "We don't concern ourselves with what someone else defines as a craft brewer." Wow, sounds like Miller's man quaffed one too many mugs of a genuine local beer from San Diego called Arrogant Bastard. This is Jim Hightower saying, when in doubt about whether a local beer is really local, ask the locals.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The Obama administration has arrested and convicted more medical marijuana patients than the Bush administration, according to new figures released today. The enforcement of federal marijuana law has mainly been carried out in states that allow for the use of marijuana as a prescribed medical treatment for pain management. This has resulted in federal prison sentences for medical marijuana users, cultivators, and suppliers across the country. Three patients are scheduled to be sentenced in federal court this month, two of whom will face sentences of 5 to 10 years to life. Two other patients are due to surrender themselves to federal authorities to serve sentences of up to 5 years in prison. And one Montana patient is currently awaiting a federal trial. KBOO's Stephen Sherritt spoke with a representative from Americans for Safe Access for more on this issue.
Raids and extensive prison sentences have been on the rise under the Obama administration for medical marijuana users, cultivators, and suppliers. Here is Chris Hermes of Americans for Safe Access.
The federal government has been attacking the medical marijuana community for many years. In fact, The Bush administration, which preceded the Obama administration, was at the time the most aggressive of executive offices that have waged attacks on medical marijuana states. Now, President Bush focused on California almost exclusively. And since Obama has taken office, despite the fact that he's made pledges, both his initial campaign for presidency as well as once he took office, his pledge to not use Justice Department funds to circumvent state medical marijuana laws has apparently been abandoned. And he's even more aggressively gone after medical marijuana growers and distributors. He is responsible not only for twice the number of SWAT-style raids in medical marijuana states, he has also, his administration has threatened public officials in at least 9 medical marijuana states with in some cases, criminal prosecution, and trying to intimidate public officials from passing medical marijuana laws in their state. And this has had a very chilling effect on medical marijuana laws in general, but specifically on patients cultivating their own medical marijuana and people who would want to bring it to larger numbers of patients. In other words, the large-scale growers and distributors. It's really unprecedented for the president to go after state-compliant medical marijuana businesses in this way.
Do you think there's anything that medical marijuana patients can do to, protect themselves, be in compliance with medical marijuana laws, but are still being convicted and sentenced? And so I'm wondering if there's anything.
Well, that's right. I mean, the information that our organization just issued with regards to people being prosecuted and sentenced rather severely, spending as much as 10 years in federal prison for complying with state medical marijuana laws. There's plenty that activists can do. You can rally around these cases, supporting the folks that are being persecuted by the federal government. There are numerous petitions to pardon the folks who are being prosecuted and who are being forced to serve many years in prison. We need help with changing Congress such that members of Congress throughout the country understand that patients need this medication and should pass bills that are that meet the needs of those patients. And so contacting your member of Congress is crucial. If you live in a state that doesn't yet have a medical marijuana law, contacting your state legislators and pushing them to adopt sensible laws in your own state is critically important to the advancement of medical marijuana around the country.
That was Chris Hermes of Americans for Safe Access. This is Stephen Sherritt with KBOO News.
The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, today proposed the most sweeping food safety rules in decades. The new regulations follow the shutdown of a peanut processing operation in New Mexico after unsanitary condition led to dozens of deaths from salmonella across the country. According to the new rules, farmers and agricultural operators will be required to take new precautions to ensure that workers wash their hands, that animals stay out of fields, and that water sources are clean. The FDA says that they hope the new rules will prevent 2 million illnesses a year. These include salmonella and listeria, which impacted cantaloupe and leafy green crops last year. In carrying out these new regulations, the agency says they hope to prevent outbreaks before they happen instead of constantly reacting to problems after they occur.
A new video released by hacker group Anonymous shows a group of high school students in Ohio laughing and joking about the gang rape and kidnapping of an unconscious girl. The students in Steubenville, Ohio, allegedly kidnapped a girl from a neighboring town and brought her to several parties, where she was raped by football players and others while she was unconscious. Although the incident took place in August, the details of the attack against the girl are still being pieced together. Witnesses have been slow to come forward, and most of the teenagers involved have remained silent about the violent gang rape that took place in their small Midwestern town. Only two students have been charged, despite a group of athletes calling themselves the Rape Crew, bragging about their actions on social media. In the newly released video, the student athletes compare the victim to Trayvon Martin and compare the assault to the 2006 Duke lacrosse rape case. Local police in Ohio say they are unable to comment on any ongoing investigations.
An investigation of law enforcement agencies in Texas shows that over 20,000 rapes have not been investigated. The evidence from the rapes, known as rape kits, remain in evidence lockers while 20,000 rape survivors wait for state investigators to begin to investigate the crimes against them. Texas state legislators voted in 2011 to conduct an audit to find out the amount of untested rape kits, since no one in law enforcement could provide an exact number of the uninvestigated rapes. Support groups for survivors of rape say the number of cases that have been put on the shelf indicates the culture in Texas law enforcement agencies of not taking rape seriously and not devoting the necessary resources to find and prosecute rapists. The Texas Association Against Sexual Assault says inaction by police and detectives amounts to a re-victimization of survivors of rape throughout the state of Texas. The group called on the state legislature to provide the necessary funding to solve these 20,000 cases and to require local police to file reports on the number of unsolved rape cases so that a backlog of this magnitude does not happen again.
Police in eastern Texas arrested six people over the past 2 days at the ongoing tar sands blockade of the Keystone XL pipeline in eastern Texas. Two of those arrested were tree sitters, suspended on platforms 60 feet in the air. The other four were on-ground supporters. KABU's Paul Rowland has more.
Although the Obama administration has as yet made no decision on the entire Keystone XL pipeline proposed to carry tar sands oil from Canada to the U.S. Gulf Coast, nevertheless, construction of the southern leg of the pipeline through eastern Oklahoma and Texas is continuing. The tar sands blockade campaign, which 2 weeks ago ended an 85-day tree sit northeast of Dallas, took to the trees again late Wednesday night near Dibley, Texas, between Dallas and Houston. Activists sat in two dump platforms around 60 feet in the air. I spoke earlier today with Ron Seifert, a spokesperson for the blockade.
Two blockaders took positions in trees along one of the last remaining uncleared sections of the proposed pipeline route, and it was a very daring and technical blockade. Their platforms were suspended in the air, hanging by lines connected to the ground, actually. The lines, you know, go up and then come back down to the ground and were connected to a perimeter of ropes to prevent anyone from approaching and blockading the entire pipeline path at the same time.
And so what were the charges laid against the different people arrested?
Largely trespassing. We don't know about the second blockader. The first one that was removed using a giant cherry picking or bucket truck, what's sometimes referred to as a cherry picker. They were charged with a criminal mischief, a felony charge.
And one of the reports I read about tampering with public utilities, something like that?
I don't know the legal delineation or difference there, but ultimately, from what my understanding is, it's two names for the same thing. Because TransCanada is claiming that this pipeline is a public utility, they are being charged with obstructing or tampering with a public utility as though they were doing something with transmission lines or a water pipe or something that was actually intended for the public good or public use. Of course, we all know that this pipeline doesn't come to the United States. It comes through the United States. The goal of industry is to get tar sands to the global market to lock in prices that they can't find here in North America. They have no intention on supplying energy to the United States, no intention on public benefit for anyone in Oklahoma or Texas along the way. This is a for-profit export pipeline and should absolutely not be considered a public utility.
I also noticed that this was done in part in solidarity with the Idle No More campaign that's sprung up and spreading around fairly rapidly around Canada and the United States.
That's exactly right. What is most tragic about tar sands exploitation, which is being made all the worse by this pipeline, is the impact that it's having on Athabasca First Nations communities. These people are seeing their water poisoned. The animals that they hunt for sustenance are growing exotic rare cancers. Mutant fish are being pulled out of the rivers. Toxic waste is being stored on their land. Their rainforests, in which they've lived for generations, are being destroyed for this extraction industry. And enough is enough. These are human rights abuses. This is the deliberate poisoning of human beings for the expansion of industry, and it is intolerable. So, of course, the blockade takes very seriously these human rights abuses, not only in Alberta, but at the other end, in the Gulf Coast, traditionally marginalized communities of color, African-American communities and Latino communities are the ones living amongst these refineries. Industry moves in to exploit these people that have less political agency and less ability to say no and to stand up to their power. So to see Idle No More, a movement like this for tribal sovereignty and indigenous rights and respect growing the way that it is, becoming global in such short time, is something that we appreciate deeply and want to support fully. Tarsandsblockade.org is our hub for any information and updates about not only this action but ongoing events in opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline.
The Tar Sands Blockade Campaign in Southeast Texas continues with a 3-day activist training camp starting today, leading up to a planned mass action on Monday. The recently born Idle No More uprising in Canada is also merging with and giving new impetus to the tar sands resistance in Alberta province, where the extraction is occurring. A growing number of solidarity actions with Idle No More have been taking place in the United States and around the world, including two in Portland in the past 2 weeks. Another round dance flash mob, a form of protest with traditional drumming and dancing unique to the indigenous-led movement, is planned for Sunday at 5 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. This is Paul Rowland with KBOO News.
Transocean, the world's largest offshore drilling company and operator of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig, has agreed to a $1.4 billion settlement with the U.S. Justice Department. Transocean will pay $1 billion for civil penalties and $400 million for criminal charges stemming from the 2010 Gulf oil spill. The settlement does not include payments to local residents and businesses who claim damages.
Former service workers at the ESPN Zone restaurant in Baltimore will finally receive severance pay following 2 years of legal action against the Disney-owned company. On Thursday, a district judge ruled that about 140 ESPN Zone workers were not properly compensated when the restaurant closed in 2010. Many of the former employees staged protests and filed a class action lawsuit after the closure. Under yesterday's ruling, the workers will receive recalculated severance pay.
More than 100 Spaniards committed suicide after being forced from their homes in 2012. In November, 53-year-old Amaya Igana jumped to her death from four stories up, which triggered demonstrations across the country. Protesters chanted, "This isn't suicide, this is homicide." This was a reference to the harsh conditions imposed by the Spanish government on homeowners facing evictions. The high level of suicide in Spain last year has been linked to the massive increase in foreclosure evictions. As many as 50,000 people were evicted last year, while over a million homes remain empty throughout the nation. A judge in the western province of Baracaldo called on the Spanish government to amend current mortgage legislation to make it easier for families to be able to stay in their homes. Greece and Italy are also experiencing an increase of suicides at 40% and 52%, respectively. High unemployment rates and economic difficulties are cited as a probable cause.
The Canadian activist movement Idle No More has spread across the continent since launching in early December. Participants originally started the protests to draw attention to controversial legislation affecting Indigenous communities. Indigenous people are now using the momentum to highlight the continuing effects of colonialism. The demonstrations coincide with a hunger strike by the chief of the Attawapiskat First Nation in northern Ontario. Teresa Spence is on her 25th day without food, demanding a meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story from Montreal.
It's rush hour in Montreal, and inside the city's busiest metro station, a round dance flash mob is taking place. Such traditional dances promoting peace and friendship among communities have swept across Canada in busy shopping malls and city streets during the holiday season as part of the Idle No More movement. Started by four Indigenous women in Saskatchewan, the idea behind Idle No More was to draw attention to Native issues through a diversity of tactics, including teach-ins, flash mobs, and demonstrations. The movement spread quickly across social media outlets, and actions have taken place in remote rural communities as well as large cities. Melissa Mullen-Dupree is an Innu activist living just outside Montreal who has organized Idle No More actions in Quebec, including the one in the Montreal metro.
It doesn't mean because we're not so many that we have to stop acting. That's the point of Idle No More. Mm-hmm. So it's not because we're one or we're two. It's not because we're 2,000 that the action is not as important. I mean, if it's not that we drum together, at least it's that people that are not Native have seen the action and now know about the movement.
At the core of the movement is Bill C-45, a piece of legislation passed in December by the Canadian government. This budget omnibus bill scrapped environmental protection of thousands of lakes and rivers and made it easier for the Canadian government to control land on Native reserves. Tom Flanagan, the former advisor to Stephen Harper, defended the bill, writing in the Globe and Mail newspaper last week that C-45 simply makes it more efficient for Aboriginal communities to lease reservation land for economic development by loosening voting rules. But many Indigenous people say the bill violates their rights from previous treaties negotiated with the Canadian government. There are also several other pieces of proposed legislation that anger Aboriginal people, which touch on a range of issues, including First Nations education and safe drinking water on reserves. Charm Logan is a Cree Métis organizer with Idle No More in Toronto.
Well, Harper government is pushing through some very dangerous legislation that affects our First Nations and Canadian citizens. It's going to impact our environment, particularly our water, and it's time that everybody wakes up and takes some action, and that time is now because there's not much time left.
Aside from awareness-raising events, Idle No More has also included several economic disruptions and direct actions. At least 20 Native-led blockades have taken place across Canada in conjunction with the movement, mostly on busy highways and passenger and freight trains. While many of the blockades have only lasted a few hours, the Aboriginal People's Television Network reported this week that First Nations chiefs are also contemplating indefinite blockades to begin on January 16th if Harper is not met with Teresa Spence by then. There's also been much support for Idle No More from non-Aboriginals in Canada. Harsha Walia is an activist and writer in Vancouver who started an initiative called Immigrants in Support of Idle No More.
Immigrants in Support of Idle No More is specifically to bring together people from racialized migrant communities who have a diverse range of struggle, particularly against racism and colonialism, from people's own homelands and histories, as well as ongoing racism within the Canadian state, and to kind of affirm that presence and allyship with Indigenous communities, and to do it from our specific positionality and social location.
When the Idle No More campaign launched, Chief of the Attawapiskat First Nation, Teresa Spence, started a hunger strike, demanding a meeting with Prime Minister Stephen Harper. After 25 days, Harper responded Friday morning, saying he would meet with Aboriginal leaders on January 11th to discuss treaty rights and economic development. A spokesperson for the chief said he didn't know whether she would attend this meeting, but confirmed she would continue her hunger strike until then. Idle No More organizers say they are grateful for Spence's support, but emphasize that the face of their movement is the grassroots people. Demonstrations have also taken place across the border, with actions held in numerous American cities such as New York, Los Angeles, and more recently outside the Canadian consulate in Denver. On Saturday, two Idle No More actions are set to take place at the U.S.-Canadian border, one between British Columbia and Washington State, and the other between Ontario and New York State. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the Afghan government released 80 Taliban militants from a prison in eastern Kabul today. The U.S. forces had previously arrested 57 of the freed militants for connections to insurgent activity. The news comes shortly after the Afghan government release of nearly 200 militants. An Afghan military police commander announced further plans to release 131 inmates from prisons in Kandahar, Zabul, and Uruzgan provinces. The Afghan government hopes the releases will aid the ongoing peace process. Critics say that the militants will only resume fighting. In other news, recent figures from the Department of Defense show that once again, more U.S. soldiers died from suicide than combat. Even without counting the suicides in December, they still outnumber the soldiers killed in action in 2012. Army suicides have increased by at least 54% since the problem first came to national attention in 2007.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, Robin Ryan, Paul Rowland, and Steve Sherritt. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Keegan Herron.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning,